720 WGN. It is Dane in for Nick D until 5 today. And this is a week that is jam-packed with so much exciting stuff, events, whether it is Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras, all the celebrations you're going to have on the food side, whether it's the celebration and recognition of love through the whole Valentine's thing, or whether it is getting out there and enjoying what is, I think it's the second largest, maybe it's the largest auto show in the country right here in Chicago with the Chicago Auto Show, and just kind of getting your kind of grip on the whole car world, what's best for you and what looks good. And on the line with us is a guy who's got his hand on the pulse of so much of it. It is Tom Appel. He's the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Tom, welcome to WGN.
Well, good morning.
Well, this is a good morning. I mean, you got to figure it's always a busy time. People drive. They've got a love affair with the automobile. They're constantly on the road, even when the roads are bad, and they are here in Chicago on a regular basis. But with the whole auto show thing, I think, you know, you're a hot topic right now.
Yes, almost by accident. But yeah, my affiliation with the auto show has put me in some demand, but yeah, as you mentioned, the Chicago Auto Show is a really big deal. I think Chicagoans have embraced this show more than the folks in most cities embrace their local auto show, and in fact, these numbers are actually borne out by a number of surveys that suggest that something like 20% of Chicago households will send somebody to the show this week.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things where they've done such a good job with the auto show to make it kind of a tourist attraction, fun for families, whether you're looking for a car or not. And sometimes inadvertently you bump into that next vehicle for you. But there are a lot of times where people, and you said send somebody, where they're doing a little bit of recon, right? You know, they know it is something they're going to have to look into in the next X amount of months or maybe the next year. They figure this is the time where they'll be able to, in a one-stop shop, have all of those makes and models under one roof. And so what kind of feedback have you been getting? And I know that the cars, they have changed absolutely so much just from the time that we had a, you know, whether it was like the late 2000s car to the car we ended up getting, a Hyundai recently, and just a lot of the modern amenities, the technology, some of the electronics that are built into it, it's night and day.
Yeah, that's really true. The average car on the road right now is something like 8 or 9 years old. It depends on who you ask and how they measure that. And if that's the case, and if your car is 8 or 9 years old and you haven't looked for a car, things have changed dramatically. Just driver assistance things or active safety things like lane departure warning and pedestrian detection, and the way we interface with the vehicle now, things like Apple CarPlay and other digital access points, are completely different than they were just 5 years ago.
Now, my wife and I had a conversation about not only, you know, being appreciative of some of the cool advancements that are in the car, but also just that whole realization that we're just getting dumber. You know, how like your cell phone, you used to know how to get everywhere that you went. You could get to grandma's house, you'd get to your friend's house. And remember how, you know, with your friends, you had every single phone number memorized. And now if you lost your phone, you wouldn't know how to get a hold of anyone. You wouldn't know how to get to anyone. And in the car, it's almost the same thing, because now with this more recent car, it has, you know, you don't actually put a key into anything, right? The key is just a fob. It has to be kind of in the general vicinity. The lights turn themselves off. You know, it's the kind of thing that you're just kind of dumbing down all the things you need to worry about on your end. You know, make sure the lights are off so the battery doesn't die. Make sure you have the key with. Sometimes I'll go out and I don't even have the key with me at all. Oh, yeah, at least have to bring it with.
That is increasingly true. And in fact, and I realize that I'm just sort of a half generation ahead of everyone else because I'm constantly driving new product, I'm actually irritated now when I have to take a key out of my pocket.
Right. I mean, it's like, but here's the thing. It is when it works, you know, and I think we have to kind of just sit back and relax and rely that, you know, there's been a lot of research and development into all that stuff. And when it works, it does keep us safer, but it also kind of, you know, you're leaning a little bit on that technology. You know, you always have that thing when you're going to change lanes. You want to make that, you know, that move and look in the mirrors and maybe turn around and look for the blind spot. But now, especially on this car that we've got, you know, it beeps if there's something next to you, and you find yourself occasionally relying on that beep whether you should change lanes or not. I mean, is that kind of a double-edged sword? Is there too many things they can build in that make it where you're just not doing some of the safe functions when it is that you're driving?
It's funny you should mention that, because I was thinking that today at the health club. I drove a car, and everything's got a backup camera now, and everything's got sort of proximity alerts. And at the health club today, because of the piles of snow, the lanes were just a little bit narrower than they were before, and I found myself doing a very scary thing and relying entirely on the backup camera and not even using my mirrors. And I knew it would work, but yes, am I far too dependent on these things? Probably.
So when it comes to the auto show, a lot of people are getting out there. It just, I think it was just this last weekend, right? So it's going to be going all the way through this week, a little bit into next week. Especially for you, a guy that's on the cutting edge, is, you know, you're out there with all the newest and latest. Are there things that you just won't be able to probably see at the dealership or on the street that you should get out there? What do you recommend people not miss at this year's auto show?
Yeah, there's a lot there. First of all, if you're just shopping, if you're looking for a car, make sure you know what class you're looking at, because everyone's moving out of sedans now and into crossovers. This is a great place and a great opportunity to try the front seat, and more importantly, the back seat, especially if you're carrying passengers of all these vehicles. You don't have to deal with a salesman. You don't have to deal with a dealership. Everything is right there. And that, if you're looking for specific cars, if you're looking for a crossover, for example, there's a whole new slate of subcompact crossovers coming online. There's the Nissan Kicks. There's the Ford Echo Sport, for example. These are vehicles that people haven't even heard of yet. They're going to be out in a couple of months. These are worth checking out. And if you haven't been in the market for a few years, there's all sorts of models you probably don't know exist.
Now, do you ever, like, when you go to an auto show, do you take time? I don't want to say it's not boring for you, but it's the kind of stuff you're already familiar with. You know about all this stuff. It's hard to wow a Tom Appel. But so are there things that you enjoy about it, whether it's the test track? I know last year, I think it was Mercedes, had this crazy obstacle thing where you're almost driving. I mean, it showed the capabilities of the vehicle where you're almost driving straight up and then down and over, and it just showed what it was capable of. Do you like where they kind of build some of those fun things in?
I love the test track stuff. I never do that myself. I'm actually just more interested in walking the floor. I just love to see all the stuff in one place. It's super handy to be able to go from manufacturer to manufacturer to manufacturer and see the whole lineup at a time. Because, like everyone else, I drive one car at a time, so I don't really get that kind of perspective. So it's just great. There's something like 1,000 cars at the auto show this year, and 95% of those are brand-new cars you can buy.
When you think of the makes and models, so many of them are familiar, but some of them are doing things that they haven't necessarily, done before. You know, whether you look at like a Porsche trying to become more of a family car, you look at, Fiat has been doing some things to kind of try to redefine what it is that they do or get like a new spot in the space. Are there a couple models out there that maybe everybody knows, maybe some people love, but they sort of have this kind of predetermined definition of what it is that you say, hey, you got to take another look at this?
Yeah, and it's funny you should mention Porsche specifically. It wasn't that long ago that Porsche swore up and down they would never build a crossover, and now most of their lineup is crossovers. And they're still the core products, the 911 and the Cayman and the Boxster, and those are their sporting performance cars. But they wouldn't be in the market anymore. They wouldn't have survived if they didn't sell crossovers like the Cayenne and the Macan and things like that, because that's where the money is. And it's funny that you have to do this business, this core business, to raise the money to build the fun stuff that's actually what you built your brand on.
Is that the way that they see it? Like, guys, you know, we love cars that are fast and red, but there's just not enough people out there to buy them, so we're going to have to make some brown cars where you can fit some kids in car seats and go from there. Is that the meeting in the boardroom for these people?
That is actually Porsche's public position on this. They've actually gone so far as actually saying that.
Now, here's the other thing, too, is we've got some friends that are looking at, now, Alfa Romeo, as a kid, I remember, you know, always kind of wanted one of the Spiders, you know, was a little two-seater, impractical, but awesome. And now they're looking at doing some things, whether it's like, whether it's kind of a crossover, an off-road thing. Have you gotten a chance to drive one of those? And what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, the Alfa Romeo Stelvio is their crossover, and it is it is a surprisingly raw and entertaining thing. Alfa's a weird brand anyway. It goes back to, we all know Alfa from The Graduate, I think. That was Benjamin's car in The Graduate. And you could hear that car in the movie. They did a great job on the soundtrack of you listening to the exhaust note of that vehicle. And you know, skip ahead 40, 50 years, their little crossover is actually kind of and wonderfully raw, and it makes a great exhaust note, and it's very engaging, and it's not very crossover-like. I don't know how much the public's going to actually enjoy that or not, but I do.
Yeah, okay, so here's what we're going to do is we're gonna take a break. When we come back, I want to let the listeners know we're talking with Tom Appel. He is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and 312-981-7200. If you have a question on a car that you've seen at the auto show, something that you're looking forward to checking out, or even something that may be out there that you're thinking of considering, or maybe even some of the extra elements that may be built into it. Because when we come back from this, I do want to get into some of the different fuels, you know, some of the either electric cars or some of the other things that are available. also a little bit on the technology side. I know you're on the cutting edge with that, on the driverless and all those cool things that are coming up. And of course, listeners, 312-981-7200, you can text in, you can call in with your questions for Tom as well. We're going to take a, are we going straight to news? We're going to take a quick break and send it to news. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. It's staying in for Nick on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It is Dane in for Nick D until 5 a.m. today, and on the line with us, you know, actually today, well, yesterday was actually the first day in a long time that it was actually easy to drive. It was very nice out there on the roadways for the last bits of last week with all the snow that we've had. You know, you really did think of, hey, you know, I wish my car had a four-wheel drive. And on the line with us, we've got the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, the one and only Tom Appel. Tom, welcome back to WGN.
Thank you.
Is that when, whether you're, I mean, unless you're one of those crazy adventuresome, thrill-seeker, off-roader types, you know, where you're thinking about the four-wheel drive, is it where there's, you know, snow and in certain areas of the country where the four-wheel drives are almost a necessity, you know, at certain points of the year?
Yeah, we're, Chicago's probably a couple hundred miles north of that point where people start to make decisions about whether or not they want all-wheel drive. But typically in Chicago, most crossovers are equipped with all-wheel drive these days.
You know, we had a text from the 773, and we'll let the listeners know they can add their thoughts as well, 773-981-7200. So here's from the 773. After driving around in the snow, I think it's time to get a different car. What handles best, four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive? That's weird because you think it's got to be the same thing, but is the all-wheel drive is just, you know, is it on just all the time?
Yes, that's actually, that's almost exactly the definition. All-wheel drive is a more lightweight, lighter-duty system that's found typically in crossovers. So most of the vehicles that we see on the road right now, things like the Ford Escape or the Chevy Equinox, something like that, and that's just a set-it-and-forget-it kind of thing. All-wheel drive is just always on. When we say four-wheel drive, we're typically talking about something you might find in a pickup truck or an old-school SUV where you turn it on or you turn it off depending on the needs. It's typically heavier duty. It's better off-road. It's going to have a much bigger impact on fuel economy. You typically do not find yourself in a position to decide between the two. It's more vehicle-based.
And what is your opinion? Because I know that we've had in the past, we've had a Chrysler Pacifica that was an all-wheel drive, and it was great, got through the snow, and didn't get, like, terrible, and I mean that sort of. It didn't get terrible gas mileage. Then we've got, a Toyota 4Runner where you have that switch and back and forth. If you're not one of those off-road guys or needing to pull a big payload or anything like that, do you, you know, what would you recommend? Do you think that the all-wheel drive is probably adequate?
Yeah, most people probably don't want to spend their time out in the storm where the leap between all-wheel drive and four-wheel drive matters, because you're talking about some pretty rough conditions.
All right, on the line, too, we've got from the 630. Joe, you've got a question kind of ties in with that. Welcome to WGN.
Sure. I got a question for Tom. Listen, I bought the wife a 2003 Ford Focus station wagon. I think that's the last year they produced the doggone thing.
Uh-huh.
And obviously, this is not a technical question, because I know all the cars nowadays can shine your shoes. But I've been driving a Toyota Camry, if you will, in the meantime. And we're retired now, and I'm thinking of downsizing. You know, we no longer need two vehicles. So I'm not expecting the ride of a sedan like a Toyota Camry. And I'm looking at the Chevy Equinox as a compromise, because she's fallen in love with these station wagon type accommodations in the back. Is that a good choice for me, or should I look elsewhere, do you think?
I like the Equinox a lot. For people who don't know, the Chevy Equinox used to be a midsize crossover. For 2018, it was redesigned and moved just slightly smaller. It's really a large, compact crossover now. I like it a lot. It's got two engines available, a 1.5 and a 2-liter turbo. Both of them are punchy. The 2-liter is actually fast. I enjoyed driving that a lot.
Hmm, okay.
But that's a good choice in that class. I would not miss the Honda CR-V, which is just a little bit sportier. The handling is just a little bit better, and the cabin materials are a little bit nicer, in my opinion.
How about the ride compared to a sedan-type scenario? Which is best, in your opinion?
I would think the Chevy ride's a little better.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, superb. I think that that might have convinced me, period.
There you go.
Okay, thanks much.
All right, thanks, Joe. And then also, too, is here's one of the other questions, and I think this makes a lot of sense, too, is could you, from the 815, could you please ask Tom what is the most reliable of the least expensive cars? And I think that's a really good question because people want to pay as little as possible. There is a lot of value out there, and I, you know, I'll bring back my own experience. You know, the Hyundai that we've got seems, you know, I want to, you know, jinx it or anything, but it seems pretty reliable. It was a very economical car, but in your opinion, what are some of those brands out there that are really, you know, making a good product and at a good value?
Reliability is a tough word these days because the reliability that we used to discuss where a car would fail to start or fail to get you where you're going is really the percentage of vehicles that fail like that now are very, very small. When we talk about reliability, we're talking about very small issues, little glitchy things that bring you back to the dealership. And you still have like brands like Lexus and Toyota and Honda that really top the list. But other brands are sneaking up there, too, and the traditional American brands are nearly as good as those. The difference now between a reliable car and a not reliable car is less than one problem per 100 vehicles. So the definition is really tough to latch onto, and I'm reluctant to recommend a brand that is reliable and not reliable because basically within the warranty period now, virtually everything is about as reliable as everything else.
Yes, that's great to hear. We always think, I remember growing up, you know, you had Rusty Jones and all those kind of things. Cars just seem to be made a little bit better. They certainly don't rust the way that they used to. I think that's neat. So here's two models, and this is from the 630. A question for you, Tom, that these are both considered, I would say, economical models, but I think they've changed a little bit. Like Kia is one of those that has really kind of upped, I think, its cachet a lot in the category, but the Mitsubishi Outlander and Kia Sorento, they want to get your thoughts on those.
Interesting vehicles. The Mitsubishi Outlander is sort of a large compact crossover. The Sorento is actually a mid-size crossover. They probably price fairly similarly. Like them fairly well. I like the Kia much more than I like the Mitsubishi. The Mitsubishi best drivetrain is a V6 attached to an old 6-speed automatic, and that vehicle started to seem a little bit dated. Doesn't make the best use of space, and it's not quite as refined. The Kia Sorento is just a little bit bigger inside. I think it's a better dollar value. Both of them have resale value issues that a lot of brands would not. So these are vehicles you want to buy if you're going to hold on to them for a while. If you typically buy a car and turn it in 2 years, I wouldn't buy either of those.
In the market, too, is another caller from the 815, letting the listeners know we're talking with Tom Appel. He is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, and you can add your thoughts, your questions to it as well, 312-981-7200. So here's the question. So they got a deal on a Chevy Sonic, and will be paying it off soon. Now they need something with all-wheel drive. We've talked a little bit about that, and compact. Is there a good fit in that class or hatchback, something that is compact, sporty, and has all-wheel drive? And that's a little combo there.
Yeah, that's actually the class that's getting very crowded right now. If you're talking about Chevy, there's the Chevrolet Trax, which is a small crossover in that class that I like a lot. The Honda HR-V is a Consumer Guide Best Buy for 2018 and one of our favorite vehicles overall. Really good use of space, good all-wheel drive system, and good fuel economy. And that list goes on and on. There's a lot of cars there. Ford just brought out the EcoSport, a vehicle that we have not actually seen yet at Consumer Guide. We just got it in the office today. So that's a very crowded market. There's lots there to choose. I would check out consumerguide.com and just look at our best buys in that category.
On the Chevy side, I got a chance last year to look at, and I know they've made some advancement to it, the Chevy Volt, and this seemed like, at least the effort there was, you know, trying to make the whole, you know, economical, save the world, you know, hybrid, you know, electron, you know, all the kind of stuff, electric car, chargeable, but kind of take all the Ed Begley Jr., you know, kind of rainforesty thing out of it, right? And make it something that's practical that the average person can get in there and kind of benefit from some of those things. So the car wasn't so cost prohibitive that the only benefits you're really getting is you feel good about it. So as far as electric cars, is Chevy still doing some great things with the Volt? Are there other makes on the market doing some things there?
Yeah, there's a couple of cars out there. The Volt, for people who don't know, that's the plug-in extended range electric vehicle. Works basically like a hybrid. Unless you plug it in, and you can get 30, 40, even 50 miles, depending on weather conditions and how you drive, of electric range, and then you move to gas if you need to. So it can be a pure electric vehicle, but if you have to drive it to Milwaukee for the weekend, you can do that. Toyota makes the Prius Plug-in Prime, or just the Prius Prime, which is a very similar vehicle. Mechanically, they're very different. People don't need to know that. But functionally, it's a plug-in hybrid like that. It works very well.
So for the plug-ins, though, is it the kind of thing that, you know, people, whatever kind of unit you need to have in your house in order to plug it in, that it can kind of fit with a normal, and I won't say normal, but, you know, an average person's lifestyle and be something they can really benefit from?
Yeah, and in the case of plug-in hybrids, like we just talked about the Prius Prime and the Volt, you don't necessarily need a charging station either. You can probably get by with just wall outlet charging. If you go to a full electric vehicle like a Chevrolet Bolt or a Nissan Leaf, you're going to need to get a level 2 charger in your house.
Okay, so there's some extra kind of a learning curve in there. But you know what? It can really benefit some of those, you know, not even just on the environmental side, but on the cost side too. So what we're going to do, we want to let the listeners know, we're talking with Tom Appel, publisher, Consumer Guide Automotive. And you can add your thoughts as well, 312-981-7200. We're going to take a break. We've got a bunch of people lined up, Tom. So when we come back from this break, we're going to have some more questions for you as people kind of get information on that next car. So hold tight, Tom, okay?
Will do.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. It's staying in for Nick D here on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. It is Dane in for Nick D until 5 a.m. today, and a lot of people are out on the roadways at all times in the Chicagoland area, and many of them this week and a little part of next week could be heading out to the auto show. Going to be making those kind of decisions, getting some information on that new or next car. And on the line with us, we have, he is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, the one and only Tom Appel. So, Tom, welcome back. And here's a question, too. I know that you're local to the Chicagoland area, people all around the country, all around the world, they drive cars, but specifically on the marketing side, is it the same everywhere as it is here, where we have, you know, car dealers are kind of we remember Solozzi Edelson and Al Pamonti and all that kind of where the car dealers are kind of celebrities?
That's a good question, and I don't honestly know. I suspect they are. You hear about these guys in LA that have been around for years doing the same sort of thing, so I suspect that is very much a national, local phenomenon where you have these guys that like to see themselves on TV and make themselves famous, cutting great deals.
You get it right. There's some of that. So whether it's the local marketing on the personal level, or whether it's the marketing, you know, some of these companies are doing. I mean, it is a big focus of what it is that they do. Certainly, they have a great product. Get out there, and like you had said, so many of the cars, they're all really pretty good and reliable at this point. You just kind of fit the one that is perfect for you. But Subaru is one that has been doing a great job on the marketing side. I know we had looked into it last year when we were in the market for a car, and it wasn't necessarily something that fit with us, whether it was the ability to take the kind of things that you wanted as far as some of the amenities and the packages. There just wasn't universal. It was a little rigid as far as like what you could get in different models and things like that. We had Jesse who texted, and he was wondering if you heard any negative feedback or positive from Subaru enthusiasts about the 2018 BRZTS not having more horsepower. So just in general, your thoughts on Subaru? We get questions like that all the time, and then specifically to Jesse's point.
Yeah, the Subaru, first of all, Subaru, full disclosure, I am a Subaru owner. My wife bought a Crosstrek last year. We're very happy with the vehicle.
That's cool.
Yeah, we like it a lot. But Subaru's on a roll. They've had just steady sales increases for something like 12 years running, something like that. They've had nothing but success, and they have an incredibly loyal following. The people who buy Subarus love Subarus, and they tend to come back and buy more of them, and thus the resale value is extremely good on these vehicles. You know, the only bad news about Subarus at all is because the standard all-wheel drive, their fuel economy isn't always as good as the vehicles they're compared to, but that said, that they are all-wheel drive, so you're getting something in exchange for that slight drop in efficiency. The caller had asked about the BRZ. That's an interesting vehicle because it's not a traditional Subaru as Americans think of it. It's actually a small, sporty coupe. And it's actually a vehicle that's also sold as a Toyota, as the FRS, and it was co-developed with Toyota. And the people's complaint about that vehicle is that it's only about 200 horsepower, which seems low these days, but if you're my age, it seems like an awful lot of horsepower. The car's an absolute joy to drive. You get it with a manual transmission, and you have a lot of fun, and it's just it's a fantastic little car. And I think that if people think it's underpowered, they probably don't appreciate cars as purely and as essentially as a lot as people used to.
Yeah, and the Subarus, and you mentioned it too, a lot on the safety issues, the safety side got a great kind of reputation there too. And we do, you know, for the show that I do on the road, which is on Saturdays here, you know, we'll do like a, you know, a first car segment. So we have, whether it's, you know, race car drivers or celebrities or rock stars or actors, whoever it is, they kind of share what is their first car. And Rutledge Wood, I'm not sure if you're familiar with him, he's out at the Olympics right now, but also does a lot of stuff with NASCAR for NBC. His first car that he loved and went on and on about was a Subaru Brat. Now, if you remember those, and I think, right, if you had to describe that car in one word, it would be fun.
Oh, yeah, the Brat was awesome. That was the little pickup truck that had, if you were lucky, reverse-facing seats in the bed.
Right.
Which seemed like the craziest, most dangerous thing in the world, and I'm so glad that that happened.
Yeah, the craziest, most dangerous thing in the world, which brings us to another subject that isn't on a lot of people. As people kind of get into ride-sharing, Lyft and Uber, craziest, most dangerous sounds like, if you would have described it to someone, you know, a few months ago, maybe a year ago, would be driverless taxis. Like, where are we, you know, on that? I know that you can't go out there and buy one of those at the auto show or get one, but on the tech side, as you have your hands on so much of what is going on in the future, what is going on with that?
Yeah, that is absolutely where all the action is right now. And if you're in the media and you're not in the automotive media covering things automotive, that's what you're talking about is the autonomy phenomenon. And it's moving ahead very fast technically. I don't think that the country is moving ahead that fast socially or legislatively, and nor are insurance companies ready for this. So I think that we might find ourselves in a position where vehicles are ready for this and society is not. So the technology might be getting a little bit ahead. You have General Motors working with companies like Maven and Lyft, where they're working with Chevy, specifically the Chevy Bolt, which is their small electric vehicle, getting that ready for this sort of project. And Chrysler or FCA is working with a company called Waymo, which was the Google electric car, autonomous car project. And they're supplying Chrysler Pacificas to that project. And these things are on the road in a number of states, and they're getting better and better and better at what they do. But how soon the public will be in these things, I don't know. What is going to happen and what we can be sure of is that our first exposure as just, you know, the general population to autonomous vehicles will be in the form of ride sharing or taxi cabs. We will not own these vehicles.
Yeah, it's still the kind of thing, and you mentioned the technology could be there, but I don't know if the public is going to be ready for it. And a lot of things can go great 99.99% of the time. It's what do you do when you get to that one word, troubleshooting? You know, as someone who's ridden in a number of those vehicles, you know, the GPS isn't something that always is great. And if you don't have an actual human being to converse with, it would be one thing. And then just on the accident side, you know, and we know that, and I think the statistics will show that it's probably safer. The driverless car is probably a lot safer. And I've heard some feedback too, where, you know, it stops for 3 seconds at all lights. And so it's probably safer. But in the event that something happens inevitably, you know, I think we've become comfortable with the fact that humans are fallible and we've got insurance for all that kind of stuff. And these things are going to happen. But like you said, will we be ready to accept when, you know, all those millions and millions of dollars of research and development end up with something that causes injury or even death? I'm not sure how that's going to go. Or even if that kind of thing, you know, you have a few of those, could kind of wipe away whatever profits the companies think they're going to be getting with no drivers.
Sure, and Tesla, which has been sort of overselling its autopilot systems, its driverless systems, and people have been using those probably when they shouldn't have. It's famously had a couple of accidents in those cars, and I don't know what happened with those insurance-wise, but those are the sort of things that are, I think, harbingers of problems we're going to run into. And there's something called geofencing, which I think is something we're going to run into. It's going to take a lot of the fun out of the wonder of all this, and that's going to be these limited areas where autonomy will be happening on a greater scale, but outside of those, the world's going to be like we always knew it.
Oh, yeah, that makes a little bit sense. Maybe in rural areas where you just don't have as many things or people to run into.
Right.
It may make more sense. When it comes to, we want to get to it, and you can still add yours, 312-981-7200 if you want to add your question for Tom. Is 847, when you think about brand loyalty, Honda people certainly have that. So we got a question. What do you think of the Honda Fit? I had a 97 Honda Civic ES for 21 years. I ended up getting a Honda Fit in 2016 because it was the easiest car to get in and out of. They've got arthritis. Do they think about that? I mean, is that a demographic, people that just maybe aren't as mobile as they'd like to be?
Yes, and manufacturers don't specifically address that demographic because they say you can only sell a young person's car to an old person, but you can't sell an old person's car to anybody. So when they deal with things like age points or hit points, they tend not to advertise them, but they're out there, and they certainly think about that. Now, Honda Fit's actually a great example of a vehicle where you have an elevated seat height. It might work very well for someone who has hip problems or someone who's getting older and finds themselves getting up into or down into a car difficult. I like the Honda Fit a lot. It's not the quietest car out there, but it makes great use of space, fantastic fuel economy, and it might work very well for someone in that situation.
So you can't sell an old person's car to anybody, but depends on your definition of old, because from the 708, you know, looking to purchase a used minivan, you know, I would always thought of it when I get to the point where I was going to have a minivan, and yes, we have owned them, that I was officially old. Looking at both a 2015 Nissan Quest and a 2016 Dodge Grand Caravan, any preference? I've owned both in the past and just got, it looks like, almost 300,000 miles out of the 2007 Grand Caravan, congratulations, and 198 out of the 2004 Nissan Quest. So on the minivan side, when people are looking to, you know, for real practicality, right, are there any things you can recommend?
Yeah, when you're looking at a minivan, I think the thing to consider is when you're looking at the Chrysler vans, which is the Dodge Grand Caravan or the Chrysler Town and Country, which is now the Pacifica, they have the stow-and-go seating, right? So you have the second row seats that fold completely flat to the floor. That's awesome. But a downside of that is that the floor height is just a little bit higher. So if you equip that vehicle with a sunroof, you can run into headroom problems for some people. I think that's the only downside of those vehicles. Other vehicles, you want to make sure the seating configuration works for you. If you're putting seven or eight people, or if you can do that at all. And try to lift out the center row seats in case you ever think you're going to do that, because they can be very heavy and bulky in some cars.
So here's the thing, too. Last couple things is, and we've got this as one of the bullets, why do the rich and famous, are they starting to prefer pickup trucks? I mean, is it just kind of a thing that comes in and out of favor? Of course, we all remember, well, not all of us, were urban cowboy. People were riding mechanical bulls. Is it just a fad, pickup trucks and rich people?
I think it's less of a fad and just sort of a reflection of the market in itself. Pickup trucks have gotten better and better and better equipped. The interiors are nicer, they're quieter, they ride better. And I think they're getting to the point where they can be equipped as luxury vehicles.
Yeah. Oh,
so
yeah.
They've caught the attention of luxury car shoppers, and they're very nice now.
Yeah, I got to think, too, you know, now that I think about it, my parents have a pickup truck, but it is, you know, it's four doors and, you know, leather interior. It's very nice. It is as nice as any, you know, Cadillac that's out there. It just happens to be able to take stuff home from Home Depot, so that's great. Last thing, and we certainly want to get all your information, people keep up with your adventures and get more insight and advice from you, but I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, Tom Appel, what was your first car? As a guy who sees all these cars now, do you have an affinity for an old car that you had that was your first one? Was it something cool or something absolutely embarrassing?
I'm going to call it cool. I think it's kind of anonymous. It was the 1985 Volkswagen Scirocco.
That was a pretty cool car.
Version of the Rabbit. Yeah. I loved that car. It's still my favorite car I ever owned. Just a very honest, delightful little sporty thing.
Honest and delightful. It sounds like you're describing a wine. with notes of spice, the Scirocco. All right, so Tom, people are going to be able to catch up with you at Consumer Guide Automotive, but give your social media and that website so people can follow you.
Yeah, consumerguide.com. You can get to our blog from there. Just hit the blog tab if you want to see the fun stuff. And you can find me on Twitter. I'm Car Guy Tom on Twitter.
All right, Tom, thanks so much for what you're doing. Thanks for jumping on tonight.
My pleasure.